Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling in association with Lacquer Bicycle Insurance. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad.
Hi, you all right? Good.
I'm all right. You all right?
Yes, we're good. Back. This week's gone very quick.
It has gone very quick, and there's a lot to get through as well. And so to help us get through that, we're joined by presenter, broadcaster, commentator. Is this a fair summary of your skills? Laura Winter.
I'd say so. That's a lovely introduction. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Thank you for joining us on the Bradley Wiggins Show. In front of a microphone for the first time in a long time.
I know. I feel like I'm back to being me again. I was broadcasting from my living room throughout the whole of lockdown. So it's very nice to get in a car and actually drive to a place of work once again. So.
Good. Well, it's lovely to have you.
Thank you. Particularly
because we've got a lot to get through this week. A big week in cycling for lots of reasons. In the rebooted season, but we're going to go straight into it, Brad. It's been a difficult week in the peloton because of Fabio Jakobsen's violent crash in the sprint finish to stage one of the Tour of Poland. Jakobsen came out of a medically induced coma on Friday and faces a long and difficult recovery from multiple fractures to his face and damage to his trachea. He was taken to hospital after the crash in Katowice in serious condition. So the first thing that we should say here is that our thoughts, of course, are with Fabio, his family and the De Koninck Quickstep team after what must have been the most difficult of weeks. That has, again, for all of us, really put racing bicycles into perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a nice subject to talk about. We've touched on it a few times, actually, over the last couple of years when we've been doing this podcast, because it seems that whenever there's a crash now, there's quite severe consequences because of obviously the speeds now, the equipment, disc brakes, et cetera, et cetera. The structure, design of the finishes, whatever it is, I always put myself in the place of the mum and dad now, the rider. You know, you imagine getting the call or watching it live on TV, God forbid, and having to travel out to Poland now to be with his son, aside from, his girlfriend or, extended family members, and then, of course, the teammates, and not just teammates, friends in the peloton. It's tragic. It really is. And as you say, it certainly puts cycling into perspective.
Well, we'll talk more about the ramifications in a second. First, here's how Rob Hatch, with the most difficult of jobs, called it for us.
Here goes the Sunweb train as well in the white. Behind there looking for Dylan Groenewegen, and we can't really see him. He's hidden. He's right on the wheel of Pascal Ackermann. It's Dainese who's ready to go. In the middle, you can see the world champion as well. 300 metres to go. This is a very, very late one to be launched. And here goes Ackermann on the right-hand side now. Ackermann trying to get through and box out with the Philipsen. Through the centre, you can see everybody having a go. Turns on the right-hand side as well. But Groenewegen now hits the front with 50 metres to go. It's Groenewegen up against Jakobsen. Groenewegen, Jakobsen, oh, Jakobsen into the bars. Absolutely hellish crash on the finish line as Dylan Groenewegen, we think, just got about across. Oh dear, that looks awful.
That
chaos
was an awful
at
crash.
The finish line. And I'm afraid I have not seen anything like that for a long, long time. We all know, of course, what's happened at this race in the past. We know that there's been serious incidents. We know there was a crash there. And until we know exactly what's happened, we're not going to speculate on anything else. I'm actually quite surprised we have a replay of that, to be perfectly honest, because it isn't something that I'm sure we should be watching until we know everybody's okay. We certainly didn't need to see that again, I'm afraid.
No. I have to say that this has been a questionable, in my eyes, finish for quite some time in the sprints.
So, Laura, Brad, there's a lot to process here. And Rob went on to say on commentary, actually, that he felt physically uneasy even having to call it. And I think even hearing it again, we all feel the same way. Let's start with Dylan Groenewegen, whose move caused the crash when he deviated from his sprint line into Jakobsen's path. He closed down a faster approaching Jakobsen with going for a very small gap, having hit out too early. Groenewegen is still visibly in shock. He did a tearful interview with Dutch public broadcaster NOS this week, saying just how sorry he is. He says, it was my mistake. I moved from my line and I'm very sorry. I just hope for the best, like we all do, for Fabio. In the sprint, you don't think about anything but getting over the line first. I saw someone coming. I moved from my line and Fabio crashed. Brad, you've got an idea about how sprints can be better organised from this point on.
Well, I mean, I think my initial thought on that was just because, you know, this has happened a few times in recent years, you know, particularly with Cav and Sagan the other year and Cav in Harrogate in the Tour de France. There was Cav, of course, again in Tour de France in a few years ago with
Peter Sagan.
No, there was another one with a rider from Kittel's team at the time, and he was a lead out man, and Cav kind of hit him. And I think just reducing the risk of a crash in a sprint finish, because it's the most sort of hectic, most high speed, dangerous part of the race, but also when there is a crash, limiting or reducing as much as possible the chance or possibility of something as horrendous as this. Because, you know, first and foremost, it's someone's life. You know, it affects people's lives, the consequences, tragedy and trauma. Then, of course, you know, spectators watching, it's not nice for anyone. You know, kids watching at home, it's a spectator sport for families. So for the protection of the sport, you know, I instantly thought of a 100-meter race in athletics and the lanes. Lots of sprinters sprint with their head down or just looking kind of 5 meters ahead and are constantly aware of riders coming up. And sometimes you can tend to drift if you're just looking that way and naturally drift slightly, as Groenewegen did. Obviously, then there's, you know, tragedy aside, there's the commissar's job of disqualification and stuff like that. But just some sort of markings or something on a road systematically in every race for the last 50 meters even. So you've got some bearing as to if you're sprinting, a lot of riders, they don't do it intentionally. It's a natural instinct when someone's coming on either side of you. And if you're aware of seeing lines crossing under your wheel as you're going, you're realizing, well, I'm probably going to get disqualified, and you may back off. It might not work, but it's the only thing I can think of when you're flat out sprinting and you're conscious of riders coming up and looking at the line, that you're not drifting and potentially going to impact and cause a crash of this nature. But something needs to be done rather than just disqualifying riders. Someone like Groenewegen has now got to live with the consequences of that and being called a murderer in some quarters, because it's bike racing and no one in the professional peloton intentionally goes out to do that to a rider.
So we should mention that as well, because I think it's fair to say we all feel for Groenewegen from the point of view that this is not something that he intended
to do,
right?
No, of course not. And in the same way, you know, we had this in boxing quite a few years ago with Nigel Benn and Joel McClelland. But it's the nature of the sport, and sprinters are the most volatile, if you like, aggressive riders, because you have to be like that to be in the final and be in that position to win a bike race. At what point do you turn that off in the last 100 metres? And it's only afterwards, when the red mist has descended, and you realise the consequences of what you may have done. So you're protecting those riders as well to have to live with the consequences of potentially, in order to win a bike race, maybe have flicked a rider, which has caused him to go and crash and landed a funny way. And I just think it's for the benefit of everybody. You know, someone told me during the week that there's talks of a life ban for Groenewegen. I've read that somewhere or whatever, I don't know.
They said he wouldn't be racing until the UCI had dealt with him and given
him the UCI need to do one on that, if I'm honest.
Yeah.
Because how do you think he feels?
Yeah.
You know, he might not race again because of the trauma and tragedy of what he's done, and, you know, the self-loathing he feels of doing that because he didn't do it intentionally. Let's worry about whether he ever races again or what suspension he gets. I mean, let's wait till, you know, a couple of weeks' time. The UCI acting on it straight away. I'd be more worried about trying to do something to reduce this ever happening again.
That interview that we saw Groenewegen sit in front of the cameras and do, I think it's fair to say we all really felt for him, hey?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even in the moment after the crash, I just felt immense sadness for both of them. I thought Groenewegen is not a rider who's gone out there deliberately to, as Brad said, to hurt another rider in the manner that he did. Yes, he deviated from his line. He did not go out there to intentionally try to cause huge injury, to maim, to murder. And I think using that word is completely misplaced here. My heart breaks for Groenewegen because, like Jakobsen, yes, Jakobsen has to deal with these injuries now and he has to come back and he's got a long and arduous road to recovery. Groenewegen has to live with what he's done and what happened in that sprint for the rest of his life, and it will forever be a footnote in his career. He'll forever be Groenewegen, comma, who caused that crash in the Tour of Poland, which saw Fabio. It'll forever be within his palmares to an extent. It'll be a part of the fabric of his life. And that's something he's going to have to come to terms with and live with. I mean, even he has said he's not even thinking about sprinting. He doesn't even want to touch his bike again for a few months. And that breaks my heart, because we're potentially seeing the end of two incredible careers in one split second, one half second moment.
Yeah, I mean,
It's not just the careers either. 2006, the last day of the Ghent 6-day, Dimitri de Fau swung up the track. He was a good friend of mine. We raced together since we were juniors. He unintentionally took Isaac Galvez, the Spanish world champion who rode Juan Alares, over the fence, and he died on the last day of the Ghent 6-day. Dimitri de Fau never got over that, of the trauma of being accused of similar things, and he hung himself in 2010 or 11, if you remember. He was also best friends, or one of the best friends, with Walter Whelan, and he couldn't get over that as well. So these are people's lives here, and I just think that let the dust settle. Let these two people come to terms with what's happened. Let one guy get back to full health. How about a bit of empathy and a bit of sympathy first and foremost from the UCI before they start wading in with this and that?
Yeah, I mean, the UCI faced a bit of criticism, and rightly so, so they made a statement condemning Groenewegen.
Yeah, that is just ridiculous. As if you don't feel bad enough. There's someone who was in a coma here. Why don't we just, for the family's sake, and Groenewegen, you know, because the consequences are severe for everyone involved. You know, we saw Remco coming across the line, he's saying tears. Lots of people will suffer from this. And I think the UCI, if they know what's best for them, will just have a bit of sympathy and just let the dust settle for a bit. I mean, you know.
How's the rest of his team going to be feeling here, Brad? So you mentioned Remco Evenepoel there, who crossed the line on today's stage of the Tour of Poland, 1 minute and 48 seconds ahead of Jakob Fuglsang, who himself came in, with a 2 minute and 22 second advantage on Simon Yates. Evenepoel came home holding Jakobsen's number aloft, tears in his eyes, a really emotional ending to today's stage, Laura.
Well, Remco also, I don't know if you saw, he tweeted in anger, in shock, in emotion, I think calling for a life ban. That was swiftly deleted after the crash on Wednesday. But it's very clear that it has impacted and affected the team enormously. And it will do, because this isn't just a teammate. It's not a colleague. These are mates. These are guys who, they live together. They, you know, they ride together. They go on the bus together to races. They fight tooth and nail in the peloton together for each other, for victories, for wins. They win together. They lose together. It's sort of brothers in arms, isn't it? It's like a brotherhood that isn't created in much else. I think sport can create that within people, that love you and respect you have for another person that comes from doing that, from going to the depths for someone else, that comes from a sport like cycling. So for Remco, today would have been incredible. Julian Alaphilippe, of course, will mention Milan-San Remo soon, but coming second today as well, Deceuninck Quick-Step coming out in force, fighting for Fabio.
The other thing I think is worth mentioning here is that, so we touched on this, Rob Hatch on commentary for us did a great job calling the finish so sensitively under the circumstances. I mean, I can remember speaking to him last year about commentating on this sort of horrific scenes you just don't expect to see and none of us need to see. But when the images are coming from the host broadcaster, there's not much you can do about it. And so a sort of, Rob said, an emergency protocol kicks in, sort of in the back of your head. And you start changing your tone, obviously, and you're very, very careful about speculation. And it's a very difficult and actually a very skillful thing to do. You've been in a similar situation, Laura.
Well, I was at a British cycling race, and there have been a number of races I've been to where there have been awful crashes, and I've had to adjust the way I interview, or indeed when I commentate on the Women's Tour of California, just adjust the tone in which you're speaking, and also not speculating. So I remember Chloe Dygert crash that was awful. I think she was possibly knocked out during it. And you cannot speculate in that moment, because actually this is recorded, yes, a couple of hours after the race, but you don't know that rider's condition. You don't know if their family and friends are watching. You don't know if they've managed to speak to that rider. It can be up to an hour before actually a family member has a piece of information, a concrete piece of information from a doctor, from a race official, from a teammate or team official. And just think about what it must be like for that family. And at this British cycling race, I remember the race had been stopped in Stockton somewhere, and there was an enormous crash, and we were hearing awful rumours of injuries. And I remember a commentator at the finish line was sort of speculating about the nature of these injuries and saying, oh, I've heard there might be broken legs and we might have broken bones. And I just went up to him and went, this is a family festival day out. There are probably family members of those riders here right now, and you're speculating about broken legs, which could spell the end of careers, which could be absolutely devastating for that rider, for that rider's family. You've got to be so sensitive, because they aren't tools, they aren't pawns. It's sport, it's entertainment, but they're also human beings with family, with partners. They are somebody's boyfriend, brother, son. They're a family member to somebody, and they're not just sort of robots on a bike that, you know, we press play and watch and enjoy them crashing and enjoy that drama and that mayhem. It's not entertainment, actually, when you see the recovery that riders have to go through after a crash. That's not entertainment to me. And this crash, honestly, I was horrified to see it. And just on what Brad said about the UCI, perhaps not sort of speaking in a way after the crash that admitted any sort of liability. And obviously, we're not going to expect them to do that in the heat of the moment after the crash. But perhaps, as you said, they shouldn't have then weighed in on Groenewegen. And I think a rider's mental health is as important as a rider's physical health. Those barriers should never have moved like that. You look at the Cav Sagan crash at the 2017 Tour. The barriers stopped Cav and he slid down them. The barriers here, it's almost as though a bomb had gone off. Honestly, the barriers just imploded and you're watching in sheer horror as the barriers are flipping over the finish line of the race and the riders are up in the air, and it's something you never expect to see in a bike race.
Brad, from a rider's point of view there, what are you thinking, and how are they going to be feeling when they're having to line up on the start line the following day after something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there'll be a somber mood, you know, everyone will be... I think a lot for the riders, a lot of people realise it puts it into perspective, in the sense that, you know, that could have been anyone. You know, I know it was in a sprint finish, but those things happen out on the road as well. And most riders ring their partners and children that most evenings, you know, and if they have them, and he wouldn't have done. I mean, you just have to imagine that. But even Groenewegen, you know, you imagine him ringing his partner that night and saying, yeah, crying, and, you know, they're saying that you did it on purpose. And this is where cycling needs to come together a little bit more.
Mm.
And, you know, every rider that lines up realises the risk that is involved and what it takes to win. You know, riders take risks going through gaps in that last sprint, pushing people off the wheel, this, that and the other, particularly the sprinters, because every inch matters, you know. And if a stage winner's took, then the team's happy, they get sponsored. The implications of winning a race are huge for everybody. We spoke the other week about riders that are on one-year contracts, how difficult a year this is for everybody. So the pressure's on to win races, people's livelihoods at stake, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it's when the riders are lining up, they realise that actually what we're doing here, most of the time, you don't think of the risk. And when this happens, or when a rider dies, as has happened a few times in the last few years, it hits home a bit more. And you think, God, that could have been me, you know, or even the riders that were there in the sprint, you know, think the teammates or whatever, I was just in front of him with 100 metres to go. And I peeled off, and I wasn't going to peel off. I peeled off left, and if I'd have peeled off right, I'd have been in the crash. You know, you start thinking of everything. You know, start putting yourself in that place, and you know, it's just it's horrific for everyone. And that's why we talk about the UCI. Just come out and say the events of today are horrendous, horrific, and the thoughts go out to the family and the rest of the riders and the cycling peloton. If Groenewegen come back and raced eventually, when the dust has settled, however many months, whether it's next year. And there's some compassion towards him. He's clearly upset about what's happened. And that's where the cycling world, the peloton, should embrace him and say, most riders would have done the same in that sprint finish, and stick an arm round him. Hopefully Jakobsen makes a full recovery. Whether he races or not is irrelevant at this stage, but just gets back to full health and the person he was before he lined up that day. The best thing for cycling, the best advert for cycling, is they both start on a race line at full health, shaking hands at the front of the peloton. That's what the sport needs right now.
Eurosport and GCN's Bernie Eisel has been publicly vocal about the incident, saying the finish where Jakobsen crashed is dangerous and that it should have been banned years ago. Let's have a listen to what Bernie had to say.
I watched it live on Eurosport, and to be honest, I've never looked at the video once more, but there, I saw it coming. I saw what will happen. Two young sprinters aiming for the line, functioning on instinct and quick reactions. But at this moment, Dylan Groenewegen just went too far. Deviated from his line. And then, worst thing, he got his elbow out, and that's what sent Jakobsen over the barrier. And that's a no-go. And he will have to live with the consequences. And it could have been avoided. Two reasons, of course. Dylan Groenewegen goes in a straight line. Jakobsen passes him. Probably wins the stage. Nothing happens. But at the same time, what I'm in a dialogue with the organizer to change that crazy downhill sprint where you reach speeds above 80 kilometers an hour, because that should have been banned or forbidden for many years already, because we all knew about the risk. If one rider makes small mistakes, you can't imagine what happens at 80 kilometers an hour. And I've heard an interview about Philippe Gilbert saying, and that's, I think it's the best example for it. Open the door, going down the highway at 80 kilometers an hour, open the door and jump out. And then you know. And you would never do that. And that's actually what happens for a sprinter if you go down there. And it could have been avoided from that point when you say, okay, we do the final laps in the opposite direction. Then it's an uphill sprint. Of course, it's not so fantastic anymore, but it's a safe finish and it's a nice finish. And probably would see the same guy winning the race. So that's my point on that. It could have been avoided. Saying that, I'm definitely not trying to defend Dylan Groenewegen because he did a big mistake. And he f***ed up and he knows that. And he will live with that for all his life. Most important thing is Fabio Jakobsen recovers well, probably comes back into the sport, wins bike races again, but that, I think, it's secondary. Most important, he heals up quickly and just can live his life and forget this nasty crash.
So, Brad, I think Bernie sums that up quite well, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, he just adds some extra kind of potential theories to limiting and stopping this happen again, which should be on everyone's minds, including, as I say, the UCI at the moment, because, you know, that's what we need to work on. I mean, we don't want this to happen again. We certainly don't want this finish again. We don't want another downhill sprint again. And these things need to be looked at, the safety of the riders and the people watching, bearing in mind, I understand he may have hit someone as he went over.
The commissar, yeah.
You know, there's a lot to be looked into here from a safety point of view. And lots of other sports would do this. You know, Formula One has done it with when Ayrton Senna crashed. You know, changes need to be made. And that's what they need to start acting on rather than worry about banning someone.
Yeah. Our very best wishes to Fabio Jakobsen, his family and the De Koninck Quick-Step team. We'll be back with more from the Bradley Wiggins Show after this.
Lacquer's collective cover is made especially for cyclists, for life on and off your bike. Lacquer has flipped outdated traditional insurance on its head, with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month. Your max monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. Plus, 80% of your money goes straight back into the collective, fixing, replacing, and helping. And the other 20% keeps their wheels spinning. It's as simple as that. And when things go bad, Lacquer's got your back. Claims are handled by experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. They've ditched annual contracts locking you in. With Lacquer, if you want to leave, you can, anytime. Head over to www.lacquer.co, where new customers can get £10 credit by signing up today with the discount code WIGGINS.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show, sponsored by Lacquer. Brad, Laura, the first monument of the season. Special dispensation to run to 305 kilometres today with a significant change of route, which meant a longer, hillier lead into the familiar finish of the Cipressa, the Poggio and the finale on the Via Roma. So San Remo is said to be the easiest monument to finish, Brad, you would know, but the hardest to win.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's also the most beautiful race to ride.
So like you say, a beautiful race. We should say first, here's how Carlton Kirby called it for us on Eurosport after 7 hours and 16 minutes of racing.
Alaphilippe's going to try and go up and over the top of Wout van Aert when he gets the opportunity. But when will that be? That's the big question. They've taken the right hand of themselves. They are waiting. The line is beckoning. But here come the charges onto them. Can they possibly hold on here? Still no action from the pair of them. This is their last little view. They're going to get sight of the line. And when are they going to go? Who's going to pour it on first? Will they be caught? That's the danger. They pick it up right now. This is spectacular. Van Aert is now driving and Alaphilippe comes up and over the top. Van Aert responds. It's Mano a Mano side by side. We need that heads up camera. Van Aert comes back. Alaphilippe on the throw. Oh my goodness, you can't call it just for the time being. But I think it was Wout van Aert that made it. Strada Bianchi and Milan San Remo. Spectacular finale there. They don't know either. They're waiting to shake hands. What a finish.
I think it was Van Aert that got that. An arrow straight sprint from the Belgian rider. Absolutely incredible. The two out-and-out favourites for this race were untouchable on the Poggio. They carved their own storyline down the descent, held off the peloton, and that was a fair sprint, but it was the Belgian that took it.
So, Brad, Wout van Aert coming through again. 2-2 for him in a two-up sprint for the line with Julian Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe, we should mention, punctured. Bad fortune for him with 35 kilometres to go, but made an amazing effort to get back on. Up to the front, 6 kilometres to go. He had a dig. It looked like Van Aert was struggling to stay with him, descending like a madman. Laura, your heart was in your mouth.
I couldn't breathe or speak watching that descent. It was awful. And they kept re-showing the bits where he was almost over the barriers.
Almost out of control. But it seemed like he was happy to take a risk at every turn. Matt Stevens on commentary was blowing his cheeks out with every hairpin turn. We were doing the same, like we say here. So Van Aert and Alaphilippe had 8 seconds on the chasing pack. In the end, Brad, there was 3/4 of a wheel length in it.
Yeah, but I have to say, actually, I was wrong last week about... I was probably quite critical of... not critical. My observation was that he may be not in the form for the Tour de France after his statements that he doesn't want to be peaking too soon. And he certainly fooled me because he looked his usual old self today. So good on him. And, you know, definitely made to eat my words on that one. So when he went, you know, it was like the old Alaphilippe of last year. But Van Aert, almost, because I was so concentrated on Alaphilippe, I almost didn't realise Van Aert was there because he's so... Maybe it's his demeanour off the bike, you know, and the way he rides the bike. He's such a class act on the bike, and he's quite poker-faced, isn't he? My eyes were just on Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe is so engaging, and you're drawn to him, you know? His style and, you know, the sort of... the Damon Hill goatee and all that, you know? He's sort of... And then obviously at the end you realise, oh, Van Aert's there, isn't he? But what was really impressive, Van Aert, 1.1 kilometres to go, 7 seconds the gap, and he led out to the finish line, and Alaphilippe didn't get over him. And going into the Poggio, he was at the back of the group, Van Aert. God knows how he moved up.
Well, it looked like he was in trouble. And it looked like even his face gave him, it seemed to give him away, I should say. Because we were saying at the time, Laura.
Well, my pick was Wout van Aert, both last week and this week. I don't want to brag and go on about it, but I have called it right both weeks now. So I was all for Wout van Aert. And I thought, nah, that's poker face. He's chilling out. I actually called it a resting bitch face, didn't I? I think I've said he's just calm, controlled, concentrated.
He's a class act, isn't he?
Yeah, and actually he then went from the back of the peloton to the front of the group and kicked up the Poggio with Julian Alaphilippe.
I said earlier on TV, if you think of his schooling and his past in order to get to the road now, cyclocross, 3 times world champion. Who's been his biggest competitor in cycling the last few years in cyclocross? Probably the two biggest talents that are going to change the sport the next 10 years. Mathieu van der Poel and him. And he still won 3 world titles. And we all know how good Mathieu is. Mathieu came onto the road last year and shocked the world, but he certainly impressed the world, didn't he?
The most impressive.
And now we're talking about Van Aert, one of the first two big monument races of the season, who potentially can win Paris-Roubaix. You know, he's won a stage in the Tour, Dauphiné last year. His apprenticeship into road cycling has been the same as Mathieu's. So they're not too bad, are they? The, you know, challenging each other in cyclocross, pushing each other to the limits. And now look what they're doing in road cycling. And the thing that I said earlier that really struck me with him is he seems such an authentic, humble, down-to-earth person. When he finishes, you can see what it means to him. He can't believe that he's won the last two races. You know, he's just a very modest, humble, hard-working class act. And Dutch cycling at the moment, Dutch cycling in terms of Jumbo-Visma.
Well, what a weekend they've had. No, but
are they better as an all-round team than Ineos, who have held that mantle for long? In terms of, they do everything now, don't they? They might not win everything, but they place riders in Grand Tours, more consistency. They win these one-day races. They won the team time on the Tour last year. I know Ineos get the job done, but when it really matters, but I mean, where was Kwiatkowski today? I think he was quite far down. Top 15.
It was Moscon maybe. who is leading from Ineos on the final
they
descent.
They seem to have riders everywhere, don't they? In every kind of race. And they've really come to the fore now.
Yeah. Michael Matthews coming in third, worthy mention for the podium. Peter Sagan fourth, both coming in 2 seconds back. So Alaphilippe, it looked like he might do two on the trot. Last man to do two San Remos on the trot. Eric Szabo.
Yeah, man.
Years?
Well, he won six, didn't he?
He did, and he won back-to-back in...
He lost one, threw his arms in the air, and someone came over him.
Who?
Oscar Freire. I think it was Oscar Freire. Yeah.
Welcome back to the Bradley Wiggins Show. There has been plenty of other action this week. We should also mention Stage 2 of the Tour of Poland, which saw Mads Pedersen of Trek Segafredo getting his first win in the rainbow jersey in 27 attempts. He surprised the sprinters, holding off Pascal Ackermann and De Koninck Quick-Step's Davide Ballerini. He dedicated his victory to Jakobsen. Cav was up there, Brad, but he was boxed off as the sprint began.
Yeah, I mean, he's always going to be there. He's a real racer, isn't he, Cav? And I speak to him regularly. He's worked really hard as best he could. I mean, Cav's someone who needs racing. And I know he's been grafting. I spoke to him a few weeks ago, and he'd been away for 7 weeks from home. You know, that's the lengths he goes to in order to try and do well. And I mean, I don't quite know what happened after that, but, you know, he'll certainly be in that position. But he'll need these races to get ready for the Tour. And of course, we haven't got much time, but, you know, he's still finding his feet in terms of that race miles, you know.
Well, we're starting to be able to just get a few hints about how the Grand Tours might go this season. The Mont Ventoux one-day race with two ascents of the mountain, one solo by Astana's Alexander Vlasov, pursued by Richie Port all the way up the climb. Port was dragging Nairo Quintana for as long as Quintana could hang on. Then Port decided it was time to go. He was running out of road. Laura, what do we make of this one?
I was really surprised by Vlasov, his speed and actually how dominant he was. I was expecting much more from Quintana. Of course, in the Tour de la Provence before lockdown, pre-COVID, in another world it seems, he flew up Mont Ventoux in a stunning race and won that summit finish. He was in such great form.
He was winning left, right and centre, wasn't he?
Incredible. I had him down to win the Tour. You know, he was that good. And then Vlasov, I mean, brilliant. It's brilliant to see him come through. And he'll be an exciting prospect, I think, for the Grand Tours in a few weeks' time. Richie Port as well. Good to see him back up there, I think.
Yeah, might re-sign for Ineos as well.
That's the rumour, isn't it?
Should you ever go back, Brad?
No, why not? I mean, Richie probably left, didn't he, to obviously more money because, you know, he's got a child and, you know, you've only got a short amount of time to make it. Plus, you know, he was knocking on the door for a few years there as the best domestique in the world in the high mountains and, you know, had a shot at his own success and, you know, didn't have much luck, did he, crashing over the years. And then obviously maybe feels he's past that kind of sell-by date in terms of being a contender now. So wants to go back and, you know, make a kind of a new career for himself and be the best domestic in the mountains and still earn very good money for as long as he can.
Yeah.
And it's a home for him. He left on good terms. You know, he still mates with a lot of the guys and why not go back?
Yeah. Laura, Ventoux, something of a second home for you. You've ridden it a few times.
I knew you'd bring this up. I've done it four times, but I can tell you a lot slower than even the slowest in the peloton. Slower than Vlasov, a lot slower than the slowest in the peloton as well. I've done it three times from Sceaux, which is very much the easiest descent, and then once from Bédouin, which is what we saw the peloton take on in the Mont Ventoux race. But I have to say it's one of the most stunning, epic, iconic, mythical mountain climbs in the world. I absolutely love it. And the pictures as well from that race did it justice. It looked magnificent. I think it was quite a strong Mistral wind blowing. So the sky was this gorgeous clear blue and it just looked incredible.
It was a good advert for Ventoux. Did you give Tom Simpson a nod on your way past?
I did, yes. Every time I ride past the Tommy Simpson Memorial on there, I always get a sort of shiver, like goosebumps, because you can just feel the weight of history on that mountain and the history of cycling and the history of what's gone before and the greats who've climbed it and the greats who, in terms of Tommy Simpson, unfortunately, who passed away at that moment as well. And it's an incredible thing to see. And there are always bottles and memorabilia left at the Tommy Simpson Memorial. And people always stop on the way up and down for photographs as well.
So, yeah, it's always rather lovely. And Brad, you've gone up Vaughan too with a bit of Tom Simpson memorabilia.
Not memorabilia. No, I just had a picture of him on my top tube. In 2009, when we went up there, I think I started the day in fifth place, and he was fifth or sixth when he died that day on GC. And I just always had sort of resonated a bit with him. I grew up with the kind of photographic memories of him, which are quite romanticized in some ways, you know, the black and white pictures. He was a family man. He had a personality. He liked to play the eccentric Englishman, you know, and, you know, aside from how he died, of course, which is well documented, and, you know, idiots that say, well, he was on drugs when he died. It's like, yeah, he didn't deserve to die, mate. Some lady became a widow that day.
Yeah.
Two young girls lost their dad that day. And to this day, you know, I'm quite close to the family. And
you own one of his bowler hats, don't you? So he's a bit of a showman. And he was aware that creating
he played
this
the Englishman
persona
in Belgium, you know.
He was a fan of the sort of classic English gents bowler hat, and one of which you have in your...
Well, it was the British dress code then in the 60s, you know, and he played that when he went to Belgium, and the Belgians loved it, and it actually helped him integrate to the peloton, because there was a lot of mafia at that time at winning racing. You had to get into the kind of Italian mafia and the Belgian mafia with Van Looy and all those guys. And that's partly how he got into the system and was able to win races like the Tour of Flanders and Lombardy. For an Englishman in the 60s, that was incredible. And he's still one of our greatest, if not the, because of the circumstances in which he had to get there.
Yeah. But you have the hat, and the Simpson family have one of your yellow jerseys, no?
Yeah. And the daughter Joanne, she went to his grave after I won the tour and said, Daddy, this guy, you could still call him Daddy, the girls, this guy's just done what you were trying to do. And that was quite touching for me. You know, you realise it's about more, again, like we've been talking about before, more than just sport, you know. There are other people involved here.
Mm.
It actually strikes me when Joanne, who's in her 50s now, calls it, they still call him Daddy, which shows, you know,
she was eight when he died, yeah.
And that was Daddy.
Yeah. On yellow jersey winners as well, we should mention the Tour de Lan this week. So apart from the 2018 Tour de France, it's the first race that Froome, Bernal and Geraint Thomas have all ridden together. Bernal looked good on today's stage, but he was beaten to the finish, Laura, by Primoz Roglic, who had the firepower up there. He had the big guns up with him, Stephen Kreischwick and George Bennett in the final selection. Bernal went earlier, and Roglic on his wheel saw it coming and beat him to the line.
Yeah, he had quite the kick and got round Bernal. I think this is exciting. We're seeing the sort of glimmers of what might happen at the Tour de France, and we're trying to work out who's in shape, what form's he got. And Roglic, clearly in good shape. Jumbo-Visma, clearly happy with the way, certainly, that the Jumbo-Visma train is going. Ineos, perhaps, with questions to answer now, but probably glad to have seen this first kind of mountains showdown and to know where each other are at.
Mm. Froome lost an awful lot of time today too.
Yes.
Give it to us in minutes.
12, 17 down, which I'm saddened to see. I think everybody wanted that kind of fairy tale recovery from that horror crash, and a crash that would have ended many careers last year. And we wanted to see Chris Froome back to his best in his last year with Ineos, back to the best, you know, that Grand Tour winning form that we know he can possess. It doesn't look like at the moment we're seeing that.
Not looking good for him right now. Brad, you said...
Did he ride for Bernal? Was he on?
Yeah, I don't know team orders.
Yeah,
he could have
he was
been
on the train, yeah,
that because... he was full gas for a while and then sat back.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say he's not the main man this week.
Yeah, exactly. This
no,
is
but
it.
He is, you know, he's coming back, as Laura said, from that horrific crash last year. And they've been up at altitude and they'd have done a heavy block and, you know, they'll come down and they would have all been at different stages. I think Bernal has been back in Colombia training, hasn't he? So they're on different kind of...
Yeah, he's had the benefit of altitude.
And obviously you come back from altitude and they'd have done a serious block of training. They'll have a lot of residual fatigue. They'll be racing under fatigue before they start tapering 10 days before the tour. And it takes time for that. You need 2 weeks to soak up that work. and then see the benefit of that. And bearing in mind, we're 3 weeks away from the tour now. The business end of the tour is 5 weeks away. So you don't want to be backing off yet. There's still time to get improvements, fitness improvements. And Froome will improve with every race he does because of where he's coming from, which was basically in intensive care, wasn't it, at one point? So, you know, it's he was in critical condition, wasn't he, last year when he actually had the accident.
Yeah.
Every day is a bonus for him. And I think if you just hold him a year ago, he'd be back racing and looking to make the tour team. You know, he'd have took that, wouldn't he?
It's a very reasoned point of view there, but you've had some slightly less reasoned points of view coming from the Colombian community, I understand, this week.
Yeah.
On Instagram.
Clearly got the wrong end of the stick. As can be done with journalists who sensationalise stories, twist it, make a new story, or nothing. No, it was... they all seemed to think that I said Bernal winning the tour was lucky. He was lucky to win the tour, which I didn't say, of course. I said there was an element of luck in the last few days, which I'm sure he would have accepted. He probably would have won the tour because he's probably the best rider in the world. But even so, if you say to Bernal the last 3 days of the tour, would you like the stage to be cancelled and not climb teen? Yes, thank you. Would you like the last stage to be reduced to 45 kilometres and risk losing the tour with maybe a crash, not form or anything like that? Yes, thank you. So that was kind of what I was saying, but of course, nothing like a good story. Translated from my comedic sense and irony into Spanish and delivered to Colombia. And then, of course, you know, the ignorance that came back.
Didn't they also say you were an average bike rider with an ordinary career?
But even if I was, it doesn't define me and it's not important to me. There are more
Olympic
important things
goals
in life. Yeah, but that doesn't define me.
I love that
it's what's inside the tin of beans that counts, not medals. Even if I was the worst cyclist in the world.
Yeah, and I love that you took the time to reply to a few of them.
Oh, I love it though. I'll give it back to him now. All this, of course, can be seen on my comments page. Of course, any post.
Laura, you're very good at coming back to critics on social media.
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy a Twitter opinion. Coming back to them, I think there's two ways of doing it. You either... People often say to me, oh, just ignore them, just ignore
James
them.
James Blunt's great. Have you ever seen James Blunt?
Yeah, adore him.
Oh, yeah, he's fantastic.
He's brilliant.
Great.
I wish I had that wit. I don't,
he inspired me, actually.
Yeah, I'm not that witty. But people often tell me, oh, just ignore them, just ignore them. Or why do you reply of this? And I just think, well...
Give it back to them.
Yeah, I think sometimes you do have to say it how it is. And you do have to say to them, well, no, actually, this is my opinion. And this is why what you're saying isn't just your... It isn't just an opinion. Some things... Racism, sexism, misogyny is black and white. There is right and wrong. And actually, your opinion, yes, freedom of speech, but you shouldn't have a platform like this to say it, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the ignorance that comes out. You know, people get derogatory for no reason, you know? I mean, they're clearly angered by an opinion you have, but opinions are there to be challenged. I'm not necessarily right. One guy said to me, you know nothing about cycling, Bradley. And I said, well, maybe I don't. Cycling is a very broad subject. I've got a few articulate opinions on certain sectors of the sport, which, you know, seeing as my pal Mario suggests, I know a fair bit about. But if you're talking about road safety and helmets and things, I've really got a strong opinion on it. But as I said, cycling is a very broad subject. All my opinions are there to be challenged with a debate, which I'm open to. But your question needs a bit more context and content for me to actually answer which part of cycling you're talking about. A lot of people that take time to leave a comment that is... not either ridiculous, shows the level of intelligence, ignorant, derogatory, personal. They've seeked you out to do that. So they obviously follow you. They know who you are. We don't have the benefit of knowing who they are. And you have to question someone who's willing to do that to somebody, knowing that they can be anonymous. Because you wouldn't do that in the street. You either risk getting punched in the face, the police being called, an altercation or anything like that. Particularly women, you know, that sometimes dealt the harshest of comments just for wearing a dress or something like that, you know, or having an opinion. Most of those people, it's a reflection on where they're in that in their life. They have to be deeply unhappy or mentally ill to do that. Because you put yourself in their shoes, sat at home, what thought process do you have? If you don't like something about something, you go, oh, I can't stand this person, unfollow them. But to take it right, I'm going to leave a comment. You, you stupid. Yeah, I mean, I bet you feel real good about yourself now, mate. Hey. You know, we never used to see thick people in society because they had no platform.
Yeah.
They, you know, but now we got social media.
And authority as well. When you type something and it's in black and white and it's on a computer and it's on a phone, it's on a screen, it's legitimized. It has authority because it's written there for everybody to see on a public platform. And actually, that opinion could be complete and utter trash, and we shouldn't listen to it. But what you get is that I'm, you know, at home at night and I'm on my phone and suddenly something will come in. And luckily, I've not had too much stuff, to be honest. I've been very lucky in that respect. But it's actually this real invasion and violation. You're sitting at home on your own and suddenly you get this message or this abuse or this challenge from somebody you don't know who has sought you out, like you said, Bradley, and come to you to deal out some form of abuse or some form of derogatory comment, or I occasionally get sort of horrid sexual stuff. Someone, I posted that I was doing a British Cycling takeover and someone just wrote, post nudes. And I was like, oh, that's really mature. And his profile is always like, dad of two. I'm like, yeah, I bet your kids are really proud of you. You know,
it's actually a platform for people, the closet person in them, to come out, whether that's bigotry, homophobia, sexism, racism. It's the closet in them, you know. It's the person that will go into the office and go, I'm not racist, I'm not homophobic, but they've got a platform and so the closet in them to come out.
Yeah, it's the anonymity as well, isn't it?
That's what I mean.
You have no repercussions. If you said those things to a person in your place of work, you lose your job.
Well, that's it.
You'd be in front of HR at an absolute minimum. But on social media, you can
The toilet door used to be in the 80s, where you could write whatever you wanted. Twitter and social media has become that platform now.
Bradley was here.
He was. That's why it's blocked.
To bring us all the way back round to the racing, a stat that you might have seen widely celebrated on social media in the past couple of days is it's been 420 days, and we're recording this on Saturday, I should say, since Big Tom Dumoulin, has ridden a bike race. So the Dauphiné last June was when Tom was back, was last in action, sorry, I should say. He finished in the same group as G today at the Tour de Lan as Geraint Thomas, 4 minutes and 51 seconds down. Good to have him back, Brad.
Yeah, you know, he's one of the mainstays of the sport, isn't he? He's someone who challenges, you know, the Ineos train. On his day, someone who challenges, who'll likely challenge Bernal and that with a decent time trial.
I think what we're seeing, certainly on the evidence of the past week, is that Jumbo-Visma, in terms of their big hitters, are looking
they've followed on
just
from last
as good
year, haven't they?
As Ineos, yeah.
I mean, they sort of come to the fore last year, didn't they? And they've carried on that success, and good on them.
But we've seen Kreischwick, Bennett, Roglic obviously taking the win today, Laura, and Tom back in action too. So we can only assume he will be stronger come the Tour. So it bodes well for them.
Well, Tom has said actually in the press, I've seen a lot this week, that he's this year focusing on the Tour. So national world time trials he's putting aside. This year for him is all about the Tour, but he's going into it with Jumbo-Visma with this sort of three leader strategy, which we've not seen work in the past. You look at the likes of Movistar, but you've got Roglic, Kreisvich, and of course, Dumoulin, all in with a shot this year for the Tour de France. But he believes he can win it, and he believes he will be, he could be the strongest rider within that team.
A lot of riders in this year's Tour believing that they will be able to win it, believing that they can win it. Laura, while we have an expert eye on the show, can we shift our focus to the women's peloton?
Yes, please.
So we've seen Annemiek van Vleuten cleaning up since the rebooted season began again. And we saw her cleaning up beforehand. So the most brilliant finish to Strada Bianchi last week, 5 out of 5 for her now. But as amazing as AVV is her dominance the best thing for the women's peloton?
So I'm not going to detract here from Annemiek van Vleuten and her absolute brilliance as a rider, the way she trains, Mitchelton Scott and the environment that they've put her in, which has enabled such excellence, such brilliance, such dominance. But I don't think it's a good thing for any sport, be it women's cycling, men's cycling, F1, whatever sport you're looking at, for one team or one rider or one athlete to be so dominant and to not be challenged. Strada Bianche last week, I was excited watching it because I genuinely thought, we've got a shift here. Annemiek had won 3 races coming into that in Spain, and it looked like she was just going to carry on and win Strada Bianche with a solo breakaway once again. And Mavi Garcia had gone out solo. There was a group of 6 or so behind chasing, and the peloton were 5 minutes back. And you thought, right, hang on, this is changing things up. This is really good to see. We're seeing a strength and a depth to the peloton that will make it appealing, that will make it a race, make it exciting. And then, I mean, full credit to her, Annemiek, I think alongside the likes of Longo Borghini, Anna van der Breggen, Cecily Upshut-Ludwig pulled back a 5-minute gap on Mavi Garcia. Anna Meek dropped the other chasers and rode up to Mavi Garcia, and in the final kilometre, she kicked on and was the first rider to win back-to-back wins for the women's race at Strade Bianche. It's brilliant to see that kind of racing, and it was a predictable winner in a very unpredictable fashion. Is it good for any sport if one athlete is consistently winning and consistently dominant, and not just winning by an inch or winning by half a second or winning by a bike length, but we're talking on another level? That's the language we're using with Anna Meek. She is on this other level. And actually, if you look beyond that, the rest of the peloton, it's exciting. There's strength and depth there, but you've just got this one rider who's doing things differently, who is training in different ways. She went on a 400k ride in lockdown for fun. She's putting in insane mileage. She trains with the men. She trains at altitude. She's doing all the right things she needs to do. I just want to see other women, other riders in the peloton step it up and to challenge her, and for the sport to grow from that dominance. I don't want to see one rider dominating throughout the season. I think it's fair to say no one wants to see that in any sport, because it, rightly or wrongly, does make it a little bit predictable and therefore maybe a bit dull.
I mean, once in a generation, you do tend to get one athlete who sits head and shoulders above everyone else. Brad, man or woman, how do you react as a rider who's seeing someone in your sport who is so dominant?
Well, I agree with Laura, but I think we're a little bit biased in that we're talking from spectators of the sport, but also fans and participants. And also, you're interested in the sustainability of women's cycling, obviously sponsors and money coming in. It doesn't help that, because you need a mixed bag of winners and teams, ideally shared out, for the sponsors to stay in or invest in those teams, because this is the races we won this year. If one rider's always winning, what teams could go with a CV to certain sponsors? From a societal point of view, you can imagine every little girl wants to be Van Vleuten in her country. And anyone who dominates a sport creates societal change in their country. Roger Federer, Lewis Hamilton, the British cycling team that dominated track cycling. Look at the boom in cycling in this country from 2012 onwards. Mo Farah, you know. So from that point of view and partaking in the sport, you need a dominant figure. Ronaldo in Portugal, you know, Messi in Argentina, Maradona, the history of that. It creates societal change, so kids are inspired. They become national heroes. People want to take that sport up. But there's a contradiction in it, and if there's no money or teams in that sport because one rider's dominated that sport like Lance did over those years, you know, that American cycling boomed, and now how many riders do we have in the peloton, how many teams do we have sponsored by American money? So it is a contradiction, and I agree with Laura, but then there's also the flip side from a societal. Do you want more people taking up the sport because there's a dominant figure and someone who inspires people and kids because they're renowned and nationally renowned and world renowned? But if that rider's winning everything, then who's going to invest in teams that don't win anything?
I just want to see a different winner. I want to see things changing up a little bit. That's what I want to see within women's cycling. Very early days, though. I just wish we had a bit more racing to get stuck into.
No, on that, actually, on the flip side of that, I was going to ask you, Lizzie Armistead, I saw a report last week because she crashed in Strade Bianche. Will she ever get back to a previous sort of dominance, world champion form? And I kind of think, I've got my own view that I don't think it matters, because first and foremost, now she's a mother who no one actually acknowledges or realizes, which we're going to ask you. Phil Digan retired to become the house husband because Lizzie could earn now more money and have her own clothing line, that, which is fantastic. She's now the breadwinner and able to, which is, shows you there's a progression in women's cycling. Does it actually matter whether she ever gets back to the previous Lizzie Arm, or just the fact she's come back into the sport, she's got her own clothing line, she's now a portrayal of what women are capable of doing? And whether she does or doesn't, her presence as a mother and a professional cyclist earning money, do you think that's more important than whether she ever gets back to that form?
Completely more important. I don't think those questions of will we...
She's an example in her own self, isn't she?
She's an extraordinary athlete. She's a brilliant woman in her own right. I hate that expression, women can have it all, because it shouldn't even be up for debate. Of course we can do whatever we bloody want to. But for Lizzie, I spoke to her last November at Ruleur, and I said, Lizzie, it's an observation, but you seem to me the happiest and the most content and the most comfortable that I've ever seen you. And she said, I am. I'm so happy in myself. And it's put bike racing into perspective for me. I remember I spoke to her briefly after the World Championships as well, where she didn't win that fairy tale world title on home soil in Yorkshire. And she said, and then I held Orla, my daughter, at the end of the race. And it put everything in perspective. And then all the girls were going out celebrating and I had to put her down and give her a bath. But I wanted to do that because I'd been away from her for a week. And it's actually those moments where life has become bigger than the sport. It's become bigger than cycling. And it's coming back to what we were saying at the start, that yes, she's a bike rider. Yes, she's an athlete. Yes, she's a sports star who needs to deliver medals and needs to deliver performance. She's also a human being. She's a mother and she's a wife and she's a woman in her own right. And for me, I'm seeing a happiness and a contentment and a confidence, an inner confidence from that, that you can't get from just winning bike races.
And even more reason to protect someone like her. If she unintentionally caused a crash that caused someone to do that, does she deserve a life ban while her daughter's at home? You know, this is what I mean. The implications are far greater than whether someone cycles or not. Let them be the decider of that. So that just takes me back to that point, you know, and Lizzie puts that into perspective. And good on her. She's a role model for every young lady.
Role models with not necessarily the same platform, Laura, as you touched on there, as the men. So give us the numbers. Men's races since the season has restarted compared to
I counted
women's races.
23
and World Tour we're talking
World
about
Tour men's races and 13 World Tour women's races. And the UCI obviously published the calendars. The men's came first, the women's then came a few weeks afterwards. But they published the calendars and said, oh, look, there's a women's Paris-Roubaix, which, yes, is brilliant. It's been called for ages. I think it will be a stunning day. It's on the Super Sunday of cycling with the Giro and the Vuelta and so on. I think it will be a brilliant, brilliant day. And I think it's a great platform for women. But I would have liked to have seen more races survive coronavirus and survive that lockdown and be able to say, you know, we're going to put another race on for the women. We're going to maintain this race. We're going to uphold this race. Trofea Binder, for example, is normally the same weekend as Milano San Remo, and it's the most stunning race. It's a brilliant, brilliant race. And that fell by the wayside. And we've seen a few of the standalone women's races not come back into the calendar. The Bowls Ladies Tour, for example, Trofea Binder, the Women's Tour, the Women's Tour of Britain, for example. And that's a shame for me, because I think as alongside the likes of Flanders and Flèche Wallonne and Liège-Bastogne-Liège, where it's all on one day and they're on one platform and they have the same fans and the same infrastructure to an extent, we also need standalone races where the investment and the measure of how successful women's cycling is can truly be felt. And we can see the fans that are there for the women. We can see the TV stats that are there for the women. That's what we have lost through this coronavirus pandemic. And I just hope that it will come back with a vengeance next year. But the financial model was fragile and coronavirus certainly hasn't helped that.
Plue, the next women's race, which we're all looking forward to. Brad, we've got Lombardia to look forward to next week. The race of the falling leaves, the race of the lush leaves, perhaps, this week.
Yeah. And also now, it's not going to be a race of who can be bothered at the end of the season. It's now a prelim to the Tour de France. So we're going to see, I imagine, based on the nature of the terrain of that race, a lot of the big Tour de France stars testing their mountain legs out. And it should make for a much better race. The weather will be better. You know, off the back of COVID, it's give us a whole new outlook to the classics, you know, and new set of riders, different weather conditions. So I'm looking forward to it.
As are we all. Well, so that brings us to the end of this episode of the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Thank you, as ever, to our sponsor, Lacquer Bicycle Insurance. Laura, thank you for joining us. Where can we follow you on social media?
At Laura C. Winter on Twitter and Instagram.
Brad, thank you, as ever, for your fine words.
Hey. That's what I'm here for.
That is what you're here for, among other things. Where can we follow you on social?
I know nothing about cycling.com. So we go. Thank you.
Sir, so be polite.
And I thank everyone for the kind word. I got a lot of nice messages last week as well as the idiots. So, you know, I think it went down well, particularly the second part of the podcast we did on touching on some mental health issues and stuff.
Yes.
And, I had some fantastic messages. So thank you very much for, you know, good and bad. I like to hear the bad comments as well. You know, as long as, you know, I'm open to any criticism, as long as it's articulate and not doesn't get personal.
Yeah, important to say that too, because there is an upside,
you know,
to everyone having a voice.
If people want to hear more of, we're open to it, you know.
Yeah. You can let me know if you like at Graham Wilgos. I should add that you can follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. and you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We should say thank you to our producer, Pete Burton.
Podcast Pete.
And finally from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts, and rate us on your podcast platform of choice. Brad, we will see you next week for Il Lombardia. Laura, thank you again.
Thank you for having me.
Brad, it's goodbye from him.
It is, and it's goodbye from her.
Goodbye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.